study of the Psalms. All right, so let's start with our summary of this psalm. Psalm 74 calls on God to remember His covenant and bring salvation through judgment for the sake of His name. So go over that one more time. Psalm 74 calls on God to remember His covenant and bring salvation through judgment for the sake of His name. Simple outline of this psalm in three parts, verses 1 to 11, the devastation of Zion. Verses 12 to 17, God's redeeming works. Verses 18 to 23, call for God to remember, arise, and act. So I'll go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 11, the devastation of Zion. Verses 12 to 17, God's redeeming works. Verses 18 to 23, call for God to remember, arise, and act. Okay, so let's go to our observations of Psalm 74. Psalm 74 was written by Asaph. The superscription ascribes it to him simply, Moscow of Asaph. Most likely, again, this is a descendant of the Asaph that David appointed as one of the music directors for worship, and we talked about that with Psalm 73, so we won't rehearse that every single time. This psalm is the ninth of the 13 occurrences of the term Moscul that is in the superscriptions of the psalm. Four out of those 13 are here in Book 3, Psalm 74, Psalm 78, and Psalms 88 and 89. Now, the exact meaning of that term is not certain. It seems to be associated with giving instruction or giving wisdom. So likely it's indicating a song of instruction or something of that nature. There's no other musical direction that's given in the heading of the psalm or in the text of the psalm. And there's no occasion that is mentioned in the heading of the psalm. But this is a lament psalm, and we'll talk about that more in a few minutes. And generally speaking, with a lament psalm, the occasion of the psalm is going to be given in the crisis complaint of lament. And so that would be the case here, making this occasion being the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 586 BC by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. Psalm 74 is what we would categorize as a communal lament psalm. The fact that it is communal or national or community oriented is evident by the use of various phrases and pronouns throughout, right from the very beginning in verse number one, "Hast thou cast us off forever?" And then we read, "The sheep of thy pasture, thy congregation, thine inheritance, and us and we," and that sort of thing. So it's evidently a communal lament, not an individual lament as the psalm before it was. Now, being a lament psalm, it does follow the conventions of a lament. So it begins in verses 1 to 3 with direct address prayer to God. We have in verses 4 to 9 the crisis complaint of the lament. In verses 10 to 11, we have the petition to act. In verses 12 to 17, we have a catalog of praiseworthy acts of God. And in verses 18 to 23, another petition to act. Now, typically, a couple of elements in a lament psalm that we see would be an expression of confidence and a commitment to praise. So, lament psalms are typically calling out for some sort of deliverance, for God to act in some way to deliver from whatever the crisis is. And there's usually an expression of confidence that God, in fact, will do this, and also a commitment to praise God once he has done this because of the faith in the lament. So in this case, they're not stated explicitly, but I do believe the expression of confidence and the commitment to praise are implied in this psalm, and that is because of the strong covenantal terms of this lament prayer, and we'll look at some of those a little bit later. So that would be the primary category or psalm type. There are also some minor elements, which is very common, such as wisdom elements. We would expect that in a moscal. I think they can be identified in the moscals. Some of the wisdom elements would be like the contrast between the oppressor and the oppressed, which we have here in this psalm. We also have references in verse 18 and verse 22. These enemies that have wreaked all this devastation are essentially referred to in their opposition to God as being very foolish. They are scorning, scoffing, and opposing God, and they're called fools. Other minor elements would be creation, nature type elements. We get that in about the middle of the psalm in verses 12 to 17. References to the sun and the moon and those sort of things and rivers and all that. And then another minor element would be that of imprecation, which we get in verse number 11. And so we'll look at that a little bit more when we get there. Psalm 74 is the third psalm of the Asaphite psalm group here in book number 3. And it is also the second psalm in book number 3. So we talked about how the first position psalm in each of these books serves in an introductory role and is paired with the second psalm in these book collections. And this is the same way here with Psalm 74. Now, obviously, being a part of this Asaphite psalm group, this collection right here at the beginning of book 3, there's going to be obvious connections to this Asaphite group. And being coupled with Psalm 72, essentially Psalm 73, rather, it essentially presents a communal form of what we had in an individual lament in that previous psalm. So it's also going to share connections with other second psalms. So that would be Psalm 2 in book 1 and Psalm 43 in book number 2. And one of those is obviously going to be that both of those second position psalms are strongly thematic of expressing about a concern about enemies, the rival nations. There are connections also with book 2 of the Psalms, which is the previous book that we studied, which had that collection of Korah Psalms, and then you also had another David group within book number 2. And if you remember, particularly early in the Korah Psalms and in the David Psalms, you had a number of themes, like these abandonment themes and desolation themes and oppression from enemies. And all of that is in Psalm 74 as well. Book 3, then, as we see it coming after Book 2, Book 3 actually escalates those concerns in Book 2. So Book two is heavily concentrated around David and his time and the oppressions that David faced, the afflictions that David faced. And a lot of the prayers were for deliverance from his enemies and false charges and all those sort of things. And things like devastation and abandonment and whatever, those oftentimes showed up as fears of what could be. So when we get into book three, we see those heightened. We see them escalated because these have happened. These have occurred. You know, Jerusalem has been devastated. So it's no longer a fear that this might occur and an increase of enemies that seems like it could lead to this and a prayer for deliverance from that, but rather that these things have occurred and now trying to deal with that and praying in light of that. So that those fears have been realized. The poetic features of Psalm 74 is a strong structuring feature. So it has what's sometimes referred to as a mirroring or a ring structure, where essentially you get the end that sort of parallels the beginning. And when you have that sort of a structure, it focuses, concentrates on the center of the psalm. That's also referred to sometimes as a chiastic structure after the Greek letter chi, which looks like an X. But generally, we see what we expect. Again, we get sort of a mirrored from beginning to end, and that concentration, so you're going to get that real theme or sort of big idea in the middle of the psalm. So the expressions, and we see this, you can see it very evidently if you look at the expression like forever in verse number 1, and then in verse number 23 you get continually. And so you can see how they are related, like ongoing and forever and continually. So other poetic features that are used in Psalm 74 would obviously be repetition. And repetition can sometimes apply to the same word being repeated over and over again, or it can refer to the use of different but related words, sort of almost like synonyms, or, you know, whereas an idea is continuing to go out. So that would, in Psalm 74, that would be a time reference. So we begin, the beginning question asks forever. We get a reference to forever in verse 1, perpetual in verse 3, forever in verse 10, forever in verse 19, continually in verse number 23. Now, obviously, the very fact that this is a prayer for God to act and bring an end to these things shows that this is hyperbole. So it's poetic exaggeration. And it's a way of expressing the duration and the extent of the devastation. And we say things like that sometimes, you know. You've probably worked on some sort of a project or something and maybe been at a point of exasperation and said, you know, I've been working on this forever, or I'm never going to get this done. And that sort of thing. Of course, you know, if you're a husband, you probably have a whole lot of projects that never will be done. So, anyway, that's just hyperbole. It's just a poetic exaggeration that gives us a certain effect. We also have, a use of questions in this psalm. So the Psalm of Asaph, he's praying, he's lamenting, he's addressing God, and we get this repetition of why and why in verse 1, how long in verse 10, why again in verse number 11. And these are questions that are expressing not a loss of faith in God, or not an expectation that God's not going to do something, but more or less an expression of the experience of it. You know, it seems like, you know, why have you not already acted? You know, you see what's happening. Why have you not acted? Why have you not done what you've promised you would do, and that sort of thing. And then we also get a repetition of sorts in the requests. So this psalm makes a lot of requests of God. Verse 2 twice asks to remember. For God to remember, verse 3, for him to lift up to stand up and walk, verse 11, to pluck out your hand, that's out of his bosom, or like out of his the folds of his robe. Remember again in verse number 18, to deliver not and to forget not in verse 19, to have respect or regard in verse number 20, to let not and to let in verse 21, to arise and to plead and to remember in verse 22, and to forget not in verse 23. So you see a lot of this kind of repetition throughout this psalm, and that's of course not unusual. It is one of the devices of Hebrew poetry, which we've talked about before. Hebrew poetry doesn't rely on rhyme and meter like the English poetry that we are familiar with, but repetition would be one of those devices instead. All right, so we want to just walk through these verses, 23 verses. So I'll go ahead and read this psalm. O God, why hast thou cast us off forever? Why doth thine anger smoke against the sheep of thy pasture? Remember thy congregation which thou hast purchased of old, the rod of thine inheritance which thou hast redeemed, this Mount Zion wherein thou hast dwelt. Lift up thy feet unto the perpetual desolations, even all that the enemy hath done wickedly in the sanctuary. Thine enemies roar in the midst of thy congregations. They set up their incense for signs. A man was famous according as he had lifted up axes and upon the thick trees. But now they break down the carved work thereof at once with axes and hammers. They have cast fire into thy sanctuary. They have defiled by casting down the dwelling place of thy name to the ground. They said in their hearts, let us destroy them together. They have burned up all the synagogues of God in the land. We see not our signs. There is no more any prophet, neither is there among us any that knoweth how long. O God, how long shall the adversary reproach, shall the enemy blaspheme thy name forever? Why withdrawest thou thy hand, even thy right hand? Pluck it out of thy bosom. For God is my king of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters. Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces, and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness. Thou didst cleave the fountain and the flood. Thou dried up mighty rivers. The day is thine, the night also is thine. Thou hast prepared the light and the sun. Thou hast set all the borders of the earth. Thou hast made summer and winter. Remember this, that the enemy hath reproached, O Lord, and that the foolish people have blasphemed thy name. O deliver not the soul of thy turtle dove unto the multitude of the wicked. Forget not the congregation of thy poor forever. Have respect unto the covenant. For the dark places of the earth are full of the habitations of cruelty. O let not the oppressed return ashamed. Let the poor and needy praise thy name. Arise, O God, plead thine own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproacheth thee daily. Forget not the voice of thine enemies. The tumult of those that rise up against thee increaseth continually. So verses 1 to 3 open the psalm with a direct prayer to God. And again, that's pretty standard in a lament psalm. The reference to being cast off, why hast thou cast us off forever? Being cast off, obviously, again, that's the abandonment theme, the being forsaken theme, which we've seen in prayers prior to this. Obviously, the famous in the Messianic psalm, Psalm 22. Why hast thou forsaken me? But we also saw that concern in those Korahite psalms, those David psalms in book number 2. This being abandoned, being cast off, it's the language of exile, being exiled from the land, which would be reflective, obviously, of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. When it says, why does thy anger smoke? The word for anger there actually literally means nose. So the imagery that's being used here is smoke from God's nostrils. You might say he's breathing fire against the sheep of his pasture. Now, this is the first use of that term, the sheep of thy pasture. It's not the first use of a reference to God's people as sheep or as a flock, but that particularly sheep of thy pasture. And it is a reference to Israel as God's people. That imagery, the sheep of thy pasture, is used 5 times in book number 3, and not a whole lot besides. So here in Psalm 74, verse 1, in Psalm 77 and verse number 20, Psalm 78, verse number 52, Psalm 79 and verse 13, and Psalm 80 and verse number 1. So this begins in this psalm, right from the very first verse, the many different references that there are that are covenantal references to Israel as God's people. And we have in the next verse, we have reference to inheritance, which means that they are God's inheritance. In other words, they are the portion that He has chosen, like in Psalm 33 and verse number 12. So being purchased of old and redeemed. Now, this is the language of the Exodus that is used in like Exodus chapter 15, verses 13 to 18. That's the famous song of Moses after that they had crossed the Red Sea. So this is the language of the Exodus. So we begin to see here this evoking of the imagery of the Exodus, and that's going to carry on throughout the psalm. So the devastation is sort of the present devastation of the psalm is sort of being contrasted with the deliverance from Egypt, with the Exodus from Egypt. Mount Zion is mentioned. Obviously, this is God's holy hill. This is where He will install His anointed king, according to Psalm 2 and verse number 6. And we've seen multiplied references throughout the Psalms to this point. And so it's as if the question that, you know, Mount Zion has been desolated. It's been devastated. And, you know, the temple has been destroyed. This is the place where God's name dwelt in the past and where He will install His king. So obviously, bringing up the imagery that this place is vacant. This is the place of God's anointed king, but it's vacant because it has been destroyed. Lift up is a phrase that's off. The word is actually used several times in the psalm, but most often in terms of exaltation. But here, being paired with lift up thy feet, obviously it means to get up, to arise, to walk. And the request is for God to view the desolation that He calls a perpetual desolation. Like this is a desolation with no end in time or extent. Then we get to verses 4 to 8. And in verses 4 to 8, we get this description. This would be part of this, what we call the crisis complaint of lament. He's describing the despicable and abominable acts of the wicked enemies of Israel. So these would be here, obviously, refer to the Babylonians. The enemies in general would be those nations of the world that oppose God and oppose His anointed. And so therefore, they oppose His people of Israel. So the enemies have come in, and we get these descriptions. You know, they're roaring in the midst of the congregation. They're setting up their banners. And like verse 5 talks about a man was famous according as he lifted up axes upon the thick trees. And it's a very obscure sort of statement. But as I understand it, to put it in more modern terms, we might say that the enemies have come in like lumberjacks in a forest full of trees. So what would they do? Well, they cut all the trees down. So in other words, they've leveled the place. They've wreaked destruction, total destruction, on the temple in particular. And that's what he gets to in the next part. He speaks about in verses 6 and 7 how that all the carved work, which that refers to the ornaments, all the building of the temple and such, and they have burned it with fire and they've burned it down to the ground, the place of His name. Now this is reflective of the destruction of the temple by Nebuchadnezzar, 2 Kings chapter 25 and verses 8 to 9. Now you'll recall that there were those waves, and so 10 years earlier the temple had been ransacked by Nebuchadnezzar, but it wasn't actually destroyed and it wasn't actually burned down at that time. But in 586 BC it was destroyed and it was burned. So their voice, he speaks of their voice, how that they voiced their opposition to God. Verse 8, like they said in their hearts, let us destroy them together. They've carried them out on His people. And it says they have burned up all the synagogues of the land. The translation of synagogues there, which follows, I believe, what the Septuagint did in translation there, is a reference really to meeting places. So we really shouldn't think of it as synagogues like we know of synagogues to be. They hadn't really hadn't really, those synagogues hadn't quite developed by that time as far as what we understand of that. But it refers to meeting places. So it would be places of instruction. And we know that there were, throughout the land of Israel, that there were the Levites, and there'd be prophets, and they would instruct and teach the people in the law and such as that. And so basically it's just another way of referring to this devastation as being total. Like it's all of the land is in ruins in a sense. And we get to verses 9 to 11. And in verses 9 to 11, we really see the enemy's true target. In other words, we get the perspective of the destruction that they have worked and why. And we get a reinforcement here of this abandonment theme. It says, we see not our signs. There is no more any prophet, neither is there any among us that knoweth how long. In other words, they have no signs to point the way of deliverance. They have no prophet to guide them. They have none among them to tell them how long the devastations will last. Now, the way that this is presented to us, when you think about the situation, this would be a use of irony, because they had the prophets. They had the prophets giving them signs and giving them prophecies concerning these devastations for centuries before they happened in various ways. I mean, going all the way back to Moses in the book of Deuteronomy and telling them about the curses of the covenant that they would inherit if they broke God's covenant, and how they'd be scattered off this land and all that sort of thing. So for centuries, they have had warnings about these devastations that would come. And now they are lamenting the fact that we don't have any signs and we don't have any prophet. It's almost like when you read the book of Lamentations, like the idea that you get when you read the book of Lamentations is sort of what you would call like being in shock, just sort of disoriented and confused and not, you know, just looking at devastation that you just cannot even comprehend how that this could be. And so this is sort of reflective of the experience of this devastation in this lament. Like, but you know, there's no prophet, there's no signs, there's none guiding us or telling us how long that this will last. And again, it's ironic, because for how long did they have prophets among them, giving them signs, giving them prophecies, giving them warnings that they did not heed? The reproaches and the blasphemy, though, we see clearly are against God. And we see that like in verse number 10, the adversary, the enemy, they are reproaching God. They're blaspheming his name. And much like what we saw again in Psalm 2, it'd be obvious, one of those obvious connections with Psalm 2, how the kings of the earth and the rulers, they set themselves against God and against his anointed. And then we see this imagery in verse number 11, asking God, why have you withdrawn your hand, even your right hand? And the request is, pluck it out of your bosom. So now, obviously, first of all, the right hand is typically the hand of power, the hand of action. And so the imagery is given as like a man that is sort of standing and watching, and he's just sort of tucked his hand in his robe. In other words, he's not doing anything. So in modern terms, we might say something like, you know, a man just stood there with his hands in his pockets while his home was being destroyed. Like he didn't do anything. He didn't lift a hand. He didn't offer any resistance. He just, you know, stood there with his hands in his pockets and did nothing. And so that's the imagery that we're being given. And so the psalmist is praying and asking, you know, God, why did you stand by with your hand just tucked away in your robe and do nothing when your city was overrun, when Mount Zion was desolated and the temple, the place of your name was destroyed? So it's the appearance of doing nothing. And so the request then at the end, you know, pluck it out, take your hand out, you know, get with your right hand, you know, get to action. And that action would mean judgment on those enemies. Then we get to verses 12 to 17, and we get this description of God's excellency in the past. So this term salvation is used for God is my king of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. Obviously, that would give us sort of a minor element of a kingly psalm with that reference to the king. I didn't mention that earlier. Salvation was also used in connection with Israel and Zion in the prayer of Psalm 53 and verse number 6. So the reference is to the deliverance of Israel in the Exodus from Egypt, working salvation in the midst of the earth. And as he goes on, again, and through the context of the whole psalm, we know that we've got these references to the Exodus. So he refers in these verses to the parting of the Red Sea, like we read about in Exodus 14:21, even the crossing of the Jordan River when he dried up the land there, Joshua chapter 3 and verse number 13. And then we get these creative works of God referenced. And we also have these references to the dragons in the waters, to the Leviathan, which is probably the best thing to say would be like a sea monster of some sort. Believing these to be references to the fact that those judgments that came on Egypt and God's victory over Egypt, even, you know, the parting of the sea and all those sort of things, were judgments against the gods of Egypt, like in Exodus chapter 12 and verse number 12. But we also get references to God's creative works when you get to verses 16 and 17, talking about the day and the night and the light and the sun, the borders of the earth and summer and winter. So these are references to the creation, but they're also covenantal references because these are what we find in God's first covenant with Noah. So in Genesis chapter 8, verses 20 to 22, and then in chapter 9, verses 8 to 17. And we know that God there made a covenant with Noah. He wasn't going to destroy the earth with a global flood. He would not do that. He set a rainbow in the clouds as a token of that covenant and a remembrance. He promised that the seasons of the earth would continue apace as long as the earth stood. So the spring and the summer and the fall and the winter would continue on. And also references to the day and night. So, in other words, not only is this a reference to just God's power in terms of creative power, but it's also a reference to his faithfulness in terms of covenant faithfulness, because these are the very things which God referred to in making his promises. And these are also spoken of in terms of the surety of David's covenant in Jeremiah chapter 33, verses 20 to 26. And so I do believe we have a covenantal reference here as well. So then we get to verses 18 to 23 that finish out this psalm. We get a final direct address petition to God to act. So the wickedness of God's enemy is expressed in terms, or the wickedness of the enemy is expressed in terms of opposition to God. It's, in other words, it's God's name that is at stake. If Israel is destroyed and they're never brought back, then God has besmirched his own name. God has let down his own name. Just as you and I would do, let's say that we made sure some sort of agreement, and then we did not hold up our end of that agreement, and we backed out on that agreement, then we suffer a loss of reputation. We become someone that doesn't keep their word. So this is what's being said to God. If Israel is destroyed and they're gone and they're never brought back, if this kingdom never comes, if Israel's king never comes of the line of David to sit on David's throne in Mount Zion, then God's name has been defiled, and God is the one who has done that. So that this is what is at stake. So the covenant community of Israel is referred to as his dove. We have a reference to this in Psalm 68, verse 13 as well. Also referred to as poor, and we see several references there, poor, downtrodden, throughout this psalm as they've been referred to. We've also understood, especially as we've gone through the Psalms, but we can see this in the law, we can see this in the prophets, we can see it in the wisdom books as well. Going through the Psalms, we understand how those are covenant references. Those faithful covenant members are referred to as the poor and the needy and the lowly and the downtrodden and so on. So again, this would be a reference to the covenant faithful. But these are references that also refer to vulnerability. The fact that they've taken refuge in God and they cannot deliver themselves. We have also explicit reference to the covenant in verse number 20. And that covenant is the grounds for which God must act. In other words, he cannot disregard his covenant. We have another reference to the covenant faithful, the poor and needy, which we know that the Messiah also identified with, David also himself identified with. And then there's a call for God to arise. This is a call for judgment. We have seen this in previous Psalms as well. And the call for him to defend his cause. In other words, those are sort of legal terms. Reminds us of a courtroom of someone that would stand up to plead the case of someone that's truly innocent, and to plead their case and to defend and to vindicate them. And that's sort of the imagery that we're giving. This psalm just ends on this call to remember. God, remember. Don't forget your covenant. Remember your covenant. Why? Because that means God's going to do everything that he has promised and covenanted himself to do. However long that takes, whenever those times are. All right, so that brings us to interpretation. What is Psalm 74 teaching? Well, obviously Psalm 74 is teaching the fulfillment of prophecy. We have this lament that is expressing this horrific experience of devastation to Judah and Jerusalem in particular. And these things were prophesied before, and they didn't believe it would happen. In other words, these were prophecies that were made, but it seems like there was an arrogance on the part of the people that said, as long as that temple is standing, then this cannot happen. As long as that temple is there, we have something of an immunity. And we have a reference in verse 6 in this psalm to that carved wood. You know, in other words, a reference to the beauty and the glory and the grandeur of this temple. And it was viewed as the pride of Israel. And it's viewed as this holy monument to God. And surely God will never let that fall. So as long as those stones and that gold and brass and tapestry work and woodwork, and as long as all of that is there and the altar is there and the blood is sanctifying it all, as long as that's there, then we're okay. We will stand. Well, they thought that temple would provide immunity. So therefore, they could just continue to disregard God's word that he was sending to them through Moses, beginning with Moses, and through the prophets to them. Psalm 74 also teaches the prayer of covenant faith. So you have to understand what this lament is and what it rests on. Because it's easy, I would say. Think about it this way. How many people have you known in life? Maybe they're family or maybe they're friends. Maybe there's someone at work. And I've probably known some in just about all those situations. They're not believers. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in Jesus Christ. They don't serve him. They're not trying to follow him. But let some catastrophe come in their life and they're crying out to God for him to help. So what I'm saying is even someone completely without faith can be moved to cry out to God for help. But what does it mean for someone with faith to cry out to God for help? And that's what we see in a psalm like this, the prayer of covenant faith. So the psalmist understood that the enemies were ultimately opposed to God. They were bent on blaspheming his name. One of the reasons why they had this animosity toward this temple. And the psalmist understood the reason for this devastation, even though he was still shocked by it. He understood the reason for it. So in other words, what we don't see in this psalm, we don't see the psalmist asking, how could this happen? Or why did this happen? Like, this came out of nowhere. I never saw this coming. No, he doesn't ask questions like that. He's merely asking, how long? How long? He knows God's promises. How long are you going to let this go? How long before you set this right? How long before you remember your covenant and the zeal for your name bubbles up and you take out your right hand and you act and bring judgment against those that reproach you? So the imprecations that we get, which are pretty common in laments as well, the imprecations. Now, these imprecations, these are prayers for judgment on God's enemies. These are prayers for damnation. All right, these are not prayers of, you know, God, would you, you know, that person did me wrong. Will you pay them back? You know, make something go wrong for them. Or, you know, they did me wrong and got that job or whatever. You know, make it go bad for them. That kind of that's not an imprecation. An imprecation is for someone to suffer eternal condemnation, for God to move in judgment against them. And oftentimes these prayers, they're very weighty. It's not quite as pronounced in Psalm 74 as it is in some of the other psalms. It's a prayer for these enemies to be destroyed and to be cut off from the earth. But the reason that this is a Christian prayer, which oftentimes you can read commentators and such almost apologizing, and people a lot of times will just neglect these sort of, you know, it just doesn't seem very Christian to pray for someone to be damned. But the reason that this is a Christian prayer is because it's grounded on God's covenant and covenant faithfulness. It's only a prayer that is asking God to do what he's already said he's going to do. And he's going to do it. He has already said he's going to do it. So it's just a prayer for God to asking God to do what he said he's going to do. So God cannot not keep his word. And that's where imprecations come from. So what we see then is that imprecations have the exact same foundational grounding as prayers for deliverance do. So it is founded on the very same footing. Prayer for God, save me, and prayer for God, judge them. It's on the very same footing. And that is God's covenant and his faithfulness to his promises. Now, the messianic hope of Psalm 74 is seen through the covenant hope of the psalm, as we've seen strong covenantal references, even explicit covenantal references in Psalm 74. So in the midst of devastation, the psalmist leans on God's covenant promise. He recounts the Exodus. And the recounting of the Exodus is not just because, well, see, back here you did a great miraculous thing, so why can't you do that now? That's not what the recounting of the Exodus is. The recounting of the Exodus is where God took action for the sake of his name. And when you read the Exodus account, it couldn't be clearer that God is doing what he is doing for the sake of his own name and because of his promises to the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for their descendants, this nation of Israel. So this connection with the Exodus and the destruction of Jerusalem and the prayer for God to act makes perfect sense. God, you have acted in the past because of your covenant. You have acted for the sake of your name. So act now for the sake of your name. Well, so we have reference to the Exodus. And then we also have this little reference in here to there being no prophet in verse number 9. So when you think about Exodus, you think about no prophet. Well, obviously, we realize that this is an expression of longing for the prophet that is greater than Moses to come. Send us that prophet. In other words, it's an expression of the longing for the prophet, the Messiah, the one who is to come and to deliver them. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15, Moses said, "The Lord thy God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee of thy brethren like unto me, unto him ye shall hearken." We know that this is a messianic prophecy. Well, the scorn and the opposition was from Zion in this psalm. Their voices and their roaring is from the place of God's name. This is where they're treading down. This is where they're trampling. This is where they are profaning. This is the place where God should dwell and the place where God's king will come to Zion to deliver judgment on God's enemies, according to Psalm number 2. All right, application. I have two of these. How does Psalm 74 speak to us today? Number one, Psalm 74 teaches us how easily we misinterpret even our best works that we have built. So think about the mindset, the attitude of the people of Judah. That temple was so beautiful. That temple was so majestic. That temple was so holy. They simply could not imagine that God would ever let it be destroyed. And God destroyed it. The works of our hands that we build are never too important to fail so that we can simply disregard God's word, go on our own way, and say, whoa, did you see that church that I built? Did you see that ministry that I built? Did you see that thing that I did? Obviously, God can't punish me. Number two. Psalm 74, again, teaches us how to pray in faith. God's glory and God's name are primary in this prayer. In other words, you read this prayer in Psalm 74, and the psalmist never pleads his own merit or the merit of the nation of Israel. Or even, he doesn't even plead and say, okay, you know, we were wrong. We messed up. You've punished us enough. He doesn't even say that. He's praying for the sake of God's name. God, your name will be profaned if you don't keep your word. And so that is how we pray in faith. We pray according to what God has said that he will do. Not our own righteousness, not our own merit, not our idea of what maybe we think we deserve or not, but what God has said to do. In other words, that will glorify him. All right, any questions about Psalm 74? What? Yeah.
Identity of, you know, self-identification, like you see in Daniel, you know, like we have sinned, you know.
Well, in the psalm before it, you did have that. You know, you did have some of that confession. You know, I was envious against, you know, the wicked and their prospering. And yeah, you don't have that here. I do think it is a proper response. So it's, in a sense, it's not like he's not pleading his innocence, but it also gives us the prayer of the righteous sufferer, which is also messianic. So you get both. Like you in the laments, you get the penitential laments, which, you know, has a confession of sin, and then you get in the standard laments, you don't have that confession of sin. So it's the lament of the righteous sufferer. So I do think so, if that makes sense. If I understood your question. Anything else? Yeah, I guess I would also add that, like, just think of talking about his frame of mind. Like, he's not, he's not just, you know, angry with the enemies and just praying for God to send down lightning from heaven and strike them. You know, that, like, that's not the way that he's praying, but rather, you know, God's glory, God's name, God's covenant. You know, remember, regard this. You can't forget this. You can't forsake it. So. I do think so. I do think it's proper, I guess I would say.
He's also not apathetic.
No, definitely not. Yeah, well, and you think about Jeremiah in the Book of Lamentations. Like I said, it's just like he's in shock, you know. And you know, he obviously understood this was coming, and just seeing it, you know, puts him in shock. All right, anything else?